As you can see on the board, we're going to turn to Deuteronomy chapter 22. Deuteronomy chapter 22. Our theme this year has been, Make Me a Servant. For us to understand this theme, we need to understand God, because really, God gives us our lesson. Looking at God who made us a servant, when we say the title is, It's Not My Problem. So many times when we're going to do service work, we're thinking that it's something by our choice, and we really can't be compelled by others to do what we don't want to do, especially if we see someone that sort of has dug their own pit, and they've been their own biggest problem, and we'll say, why does that fall on me? They made their choices, and now they're suffering their consequences, and they made their bed, let them lay in it. Here in this passage, we see that sometimes opportunities come so that we might show the kindness of God. Here in Deuteronomy chapter 22, it revolves around lost animals. Lost animals. Deuteronomy chapter 22 and verse 1, you shall not see your brother's ox or his sheep go astray. Going astray and ignore them. You shall take them back to your brother. And if he does not live near you, and you do not know who he is, you shall bring it home to your house, and it shall stay with you until your brother seeks it. Then you shall restore it to him. And, verse 3, you shall do the same with his donkey or with his garment or with anything lost of your brother's, which he loses, and you find, you may not ignore it. You shall not see your brother's donkey or his ox fallen down by the way and ignore them. You shall help him to lift them up again. So we see a couple of different categories, the first of which is, he says, it's a brother that you know. And you say, oh, I see those oxen or I see those sheep. I'm going to keep those for him because they're lost. They've gone astray, and we want to be sure that they get back to him. But also we see in the second sense that it's owned by a brother which you don't know. What I like about the construction of this sentence is it's calling that person a brother. So even though it's someone that you don't know, you see that there's an animal, and you don't know who it belongs to, and you say, okay, whoever it belongs to, that's my brother. Kind of goes back to the idea that my neighbor is my brother. No matter who my neighbor is, that's someone that may be my next best friend. Could be someone that will never be a best friend. It's someone that, by chance, we will make an acquaintance because of this lost animal. And you're thinking, well, that's easy. That's really easy. Everybody loves animals, and no one wants to see harm to an animal. Well, I had a neighbor, his cows were out, and I went over there and knocked on his door, and I said, hey, neighbor, I said, your cows are out. And he says, don't you know it's open range? He thought I was coming over there to complain because his cows were tromping through my garden or maybe across my landscape. And he thought I was going to register a complaint, maybe even file a lawsuit. And his first response was, don't you know, this is Colorado. This is open range. In other words, I don't have to fence my cows in. You have to fence them out. And I said, well, actually what I was concerned about is they're going across the highway. I didn't want them to get hit. And I certainly wouldn't want someone to have a vehicle accident with a cow and someone get killed, maybe. And he says, oh, okay. Well, he really lightened up. And you're thinking, wow, we've become so tense because we're afraid of each other that even when it's involving an animal and the care of an animal, we won't lighten up and let that do something for us. The good news is 2 weeks ago, someone knocked at my door and they said, hey, you don't know me, but someone put your mail in my box, okay? And we've got one of those cluster boxes. He says, instead of me sending it back to the whole system, finally you'd get it. He says, I thought I'd just come over, you know, two blocks over. I thought I would come over and just knock on the door and here you go. And I said, that is me. I like that. I like it. And most people would say, it's not my problem. It was misdelivered. Send it back through the system. They make mistakes. And my neighbor didn't do that. He thought of an occasion to meet me, find out who I was, and hand me a piece of mail. And I like that. I really do like that. So when you look at this, and we have for our title that it's not my problem. It's not my problem. In other words, I've got my burdens in life, my responsibilities. I take care of what is my responsibility, but if it's someone else's, I'm not going to get involved. I don't want to interfere. And I know there's passages in Scripture, and this lesson's not on that, but we're not to meddle in other people's affairs. If you see someone having an argument, you want to jump right in. It says in the Proverbs, it's like taking a wild dog by the ears. You don't take a wild dog by the ears. You don't jump into what's not your business. Minding your own business is a virtue. In the New Testament, likewise, 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, that we with simplicity, with quietness, we take care of that which is our duty to do. I understand all about that, but he's saying that you see that there's a problem. There is a problem. And it's a problem that you can attend to. And let me say at this point that we who are the people of God, we believe that we know how solutions come about because we have the God of peace. We have the God of power. We have the God of promise. We have the God of hope. That's who we are as God's people. And if we were to step back and say, not us, not our problem, really, we're not interjecting ourselves as people with solutions. We're not, but God does. And so when it's not my problem, Jesus got involved. It wasn't his problem when I committed sin. I like the passage that Desmond read in Luke chapter 11, verses 17. Actually, 11 through 19, not 17 through 19, but 11 through 19. And what you see there is that 3 or 10 lepers, they say, Lord, cure us. And Jesus looked at them and said, you're cured. Go to the priest, show him that you're cleansed, and he can certify that you're not a leper anymore. Jesus could have said, ew, leprosy. I don't want to be involved in that. And that was the concept. Lepers had to self-declare, we're lepers, stay away, we're lepers. So the people didn't have to get involved in their uncleanness. You've got something here that's corruption. Jesus is willing to get involved. And then Jesus had one only that returned and gave thanks. The other 9 did not. But he did get involved. In Romans chapter 5, verses 6 through 11, it talks about why we were yet sinners, that Christ died for us. That this demonstrated his love, and it's not on the board, but if you would, turn to Ephesians chapter 2. Look at Ephesians chapter 2, because I think kindness, and I'm saying the word kindness with a capital K, it's not capitalized here, but sometimes I just say that so that I can emphasize it to myself. That what Jesus did for me while I was in my sin was he took on my problem. He could have said this, idiot, told you not to sin, look at where it got you. You deserve everything that's happening here. Jesus didn't say that. He did not. And so we have God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish but have everlasting life. God's love says those who are sinners, those who are their own problem. We weren't a problem that God had to arrest. We were a problem that he chose to help. Here in Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 1, he says, and you were dead in the trespasses and sins in which you once walked. Notice where he squarely puts the responsibility of this deadness. This deadness. In the New Testament time, the word dead meant really dead, vile dead, disgusting dead. When something's dead, we separate ourselves from it. In fact, we live in such an insulated society that we don't get around dead stuff. We let somebody else take care of it. If something gets hit on the road, somebody else takes care of that. It's the dead stuff. If a body died among Israel, and that is still true today, within 24 hours, they bury that body. Within 24 hours. They don't embalm in Israel. They bury that body within 24 hours. They do not want to be associated with that corruption. They want that corruption to be separated from them. Dead is something with which only priests normally in the Old Testament would acquaint themselves, and then after they dealt with that which was dead, they would have to go through a cleansing process. Here he's saying that walking, breathing human beings, he says, you were dead in your trespasses and sins. Walking human beings. He says, because you once walked, he says, in the course of this world, following the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that is now at work in the sons of disobedience, verse 3, Ephesians 2, verse 3, among whom we all once lived in the passions of our flesh, carrying out the desires, he says, of the body and the mind, and were by nature children of wrath, like the rest of mankind. So basically, there's your death certificate. In verse 4, he says, but God, being rich in mercy because of the great love with which he loved us, even when we were dead in our trespasses, made us alive together with Christ. By grace, he says, you have been saved, and raised up with him and seated us with him in the heavenly places in Christ Jesus, so that in the coming ages he might show the immeasurable riches of his grace in kindness toward us in Jesus Christ. Christ Jesus, in some translations. He said this. He said the reason why Jesus took on our problem is because of the kindness of God. The kindness of God. Nothing compelled Jesus to do this. Nothing forced Jesus to do this. He did it because of kindness. Someone might say, not my problem. I got people with problems all around me, and they got problems. They made poor choices. Well, to me, that's sort of prejudiced, that I think everybody's got a problem, made a poor choice. Didn't Job's three friends think that about him? Here, Job, he was suffering, lost his family, lost his income, lost his health, and his three friends show up, and they say, hey, you got problems. Your problems are because you messed up. And so we assume those kinds of things. Somebody's broke, we say they messed up. Somebody has a relationship problem, it's because they messed up. Someone has a health problem, we say they made poor choices. My mother used to say when people get sick, she says, you hadn't been living right. You haven't been living right. She was just joking about that because she knows you can live right. And just like Job, you can get sick. You can get sick. But sometimes we think cause and effect. Everything's about cause and effect. God doesn't use that against us. God, with his kindness, doesn't treat us like we treated him. God, with his kindness, doesn't abandon us because we are indignant against him. He has offered his best, that is, Jesus Christ. And I want to go back to that word kindness. And I'm putting it in my mind with a capital K, okay? That is kindness. When someone thinks, not my problem, oftentimes they are exempting themselves from any action. No responsibility, no burden. Last week we talked about the Samaritan, the Good Samaritan, and the fact that two people walked by that man that had been assaulted and left for dead after all of his belongings were taken. Two people walked by, both a Levite and a priest, and we don't know why they walked by, but it says they walked by on the other side. And what I'm thinking was a possibility, they looked at him and they said, that's trouble. And maybe that guy that got assaulted was looking for trouble and he found it, and we're not. We're going to steer clear. Because that's trouble. You're getting involved with people that have trouble in their lives. And so when we say, we have the heart of God, make me a servant, we don't exempt ourselves from that which is going to involve our hands in that which is a problem. That which is a problem. It tackles problems. That's the heart of God. That's what we do. Then we see this. When it's on the theme of make me a servant, I might say it's not my problem, but Jesus is teaching that I need to get involved. I need to defend the oppressed, the fatherless, and the widows. If you look at Isaiah chapter 1, what you see is that God is very irate at his people. The reason being is that they have exempted themselves from their responsibility toward others. And this one in particular is one in which he mentions those who are helpless, and the most helpless of society are the elderly and then the young, because they cannot advocate for themselves. Isaiah chapter 1 and verse 17, he says, Learn to do good, seek justice, correct opposition, bring justice to the fatherless, and plead the widow's cause. Here's someone that's got a problem. So we go back and we say, the reason why these people have a problem is because they have a sick society. Maybe this is a widow. She chose poorly. She didn't choose a good husband. And people might conclude that, well, she's a widow. Glad I'm not. Don't know what all cause is. Here are children who need to be mentored, children who need to be fed and housed. And we think, well, who could deal with that? They come from bad communities, bad families, it's bad blood. He doesn't say to assess that. He says simply look at what the circumstance is and not conclude it's not my problem. Get involved. Get involved. Again, we live in an insulated society here in the United States of America. You can shut yourself off from anything and everything. And I remember the Buzans, they moved away here about 3 years ago. But anyway, every time I turned around, they were getting involved in somebody else's life in our community, if any of you remember that. And I could preach probably about 20 sermons on how to get that done, but they preached a really loud one with their actions. If they got any sense of someone that they could get involved with, they didn't even think about it. They just got involved. Regardless of age, whether it be those who are elderly or those who are young. And I appreciate that heart, and it was waking me up. When it comes for caring for the poor, a couple of Proverbs. Proverbs chapter 19, then Proverbs chapter 21. A couple of Proverbs there I want you to look at. The idea is this, that we are poor. We are all poor in a sense that without God, we are impoverished. So Proverbs chapter 19, when he says in verse 17, whoever is generous to the poor lends to the Lord, and he will repay him for his deed. And sometimes we're thinking about, well, I give the poor what's mine, then I become poor. And he says, actually, you don't. He says, you give what you have to the poor, and the Lord's taking care of you because you've just lent it to the Lord. That's pretty powerful. Then Proverbs chapter 21, verse 13. Whoever closes his ear to the cry of the poor will himself call out and not be answered. I have a couple of approaches on this. If I am deaf to the needs of someone that's poor, God is deaf to me. But if I am listening to the needs of the poor, then God is listening to me, a very impoverished person, in comparison to God. Spiritually, I can be desolate. God says, I will hear you. I will listen. I want you to be spiritually rich. And so if I'm giving something of my means, something God says, I can easily replace that, then I am going to be spiritually richer. I'm going to be spiritually richer. When we stand before God in judgment, our assets and belongings are going to mean nothing. But our spiritual health means everything, because all I stand before him with is my record and those treasures of which I've laid up in heaven. That's my kindness that I've shown others. I can do that. Sometimes for the poor, this is what I do, and this is sort of my mindset. I'm thinking about daily bread. Jesus said, pray this, give us this day our daily bread. So I'm thinking that. I can't solve the poor person's monthly budget. I probably can't even solve their weekly budget. But what I can do is I can share. I can share what I have. And what I can give them is my kindness. I can give them some time. And probably that's the most valuable thing. Is not to say that I'm going to solve your journey, but I'm going to walk with you on this journey. That's the teaching. The poor are a problem. They are a problem. And usually the poor can't find anybody that'll give them the time of day. God does. I can give the good news to sinners. Philippians chapter 1, verses 14 through 16. These are people who are enslaved to sin. And once again, when you see this, it's not appetizing. It's not something with which we want to associate or draw close to, and we're certainly not wanting to fellowship those who, or not wanting to fellowship their sin, even though we want them to be adopted by God so that we might be in fellowship with them in spiritual walk. But Philippians chapter, let's go to Philippians chapter 2. I want to go to Philippians chapter 2. I don't know why it says 1, but it's supposed to be 2. When he says in verse 14, do all things without grumbling or disputing, that you may be blameless and innocent children of God without blemish in the midst of a crooked and twisted generation. Let's just stop there. Someone says, wow, can you believe how people act that live on my street? So we have the idea that the Christians are a community that we want to be around, and everyone else we want to separate ourselves from. And when you isolate yourself as such, you're not doing what he's teaching here, because he tells us here that we are going to shine as lights of the world. So once again, we see in verse 14, do all things without grumbling or disputing, that you may be blameless and innocent children of God without blemish. So he's telling us not to act like him, but you're in the midst of a crooked and twisted generation among whom you shine as lights in the world, holding fast to the word of life, so that in the day of Christ I may be proud that I did not run in vain or labor in vain. The Apostle Paul is teaching how that we affect sinners unto God. Again, we have the solution, don't we? And we might look at someone. Let's say, for instance, we're looking at someone that really is reckless with their words. They're reckless with what they eat, with what they drink, with how they spend their money. They're reckless with how they treat their children. And we're thinking, that's not my problem. Just let them live to themselves. It's amazing what can happen in that situation is these are people that live near you. Those people of which you say are not your problem may marry your daughter. They may marry your son. And you're saying, we're not going to let that happen. No, you're not going to stop it from happening. And I'm not a prophet, and I'm not trying to wish any negativity on anyone. But the idea is this, that the way of which the Lord tells us to address this is that we bring those who make poor choices, sinful choices, to the healing of God, to the walk with God, not distancing ourselves from them, saying it's not my problem. We need to understand that. And because it's our culture. It's who we are. I used to hear this expression, maybe some of you heard it, that the church eventually will reflect the culture that it lives among. Some of the church does. It doesn't have to, but oftentimes God's people grow to reflect the culture that's around them. Actually, God wants the opposite. He wants the culture around us so that it might grow to reflect His people. That's what we need to push for. That's what we need to push for. Because as generation goes on, we don't have ultimate control. We can't isolate ourselves. We might do that for ourselves. We won't do that for our children. We won't do that for our grandchildren. Someone says, that's a commune. That is a commune. God didn't set up a commune. What he set up was those who are lights in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation. And then bear with those who are spiritually untaught or weak. These are Christians that maybe they don't have mature thinking. I think about Moses. Here, Moses, at age 80, starts leading the Israelites, millions of people. He's going to go out of Egypt, take them to the promised land. And he is incensed at these stiff-necked, rebellious, immature people. Remember when he was going to get water for them at the rock in Numbers chapter 20, and he makes that statement, must we fetch you rebels water from this rock? In other words, I've had it with you people. Grow up. And And of course, God condemned him because God says, you failed to sanctify me in the eyes of Israel. It's difficult. Moses is leading the Israelites and he's thinking, this is not my problem. This is not my problem. It's difficult. So my thought is this. When I turn 80, I'll probably have the same attitude as Moses, saying these people are helpless. They can't be. You know, it's all the people I try to affect in my life. You know, there's just a lot of failure. And you're like, wow, trying to help people and so forth, and they're their own worst enemy. Maybe I'll jump off the deep end at that. I don't know. No, that's not where I'm at. This is where I'm at. In the New Testament, it tells me it's worth it that I will bear with those who are weak, that I will encourage, that I will comfort. It will make a difference. And I love this. When somebody who sees that I need a little encouragement and uplifting to get my mind straight. And by the way, I bounce off of a whole lot of you people to get that occasionally. I do. I don't hold back. But in other words, we can do this. It's the strength of God. We can get done the task of Christianity in my life, and I can help others get the task of Christianity done in their life. A couple of passages I said. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, and we begin in verse 14. Verse 14. And we urge you, brothers, admonish the idle, encourage the faint-hearted, help the weak, be patient with them all. He's saying that you're going to have among you Christians who are faint-hearted, Christians who are weak in their faith, Christians who haven't grown like you wanted them to. We're going to have Christians. And so we don't come together as assembly and everybody's just super polished. Everybody's a work in progress. We're all a work in progress. We've got to work with each other in that regard. In Romans chapter 15, probably the outlook of the Jew was, we've been in the family of God forever. These Gentiles, they are just so pathetic. They don't know much. What are we going to do for people who are so ignorant? And he says, we who are strong have an obligation to bear with the failings of the weak and not to please ourselves. Let each of us please his neighbor for his good, to build him up. In verse 3 also, he says, for Christ did not please himself, but as it is written, the reproaches of those who reproached you fell on me. He's talking about that which serves. Strong Christians serving those who are not as knowledgeable. Strong Christians serving those who are struggling. He says, you've got to serve. You've got to serve. And so as we look at this theme, the theme of make me a servant, what we see is this, that we must be willing to burden ourselves with the problems of others. We must not say, it's not my problem. I'm through preaching now.